Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
Oh, what's going on, Internet?
Oh, and today is a real fun one. Like, just hands down fun. It has a few issues, but we'll get into those.
Yeah.
This is week three of our Pride coverage, and so once again, we are going to watch something real gay. And in this case, it is the absolutely fantastic Australian indie flick from 1994. You already know what I'm going to say. It's Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
They're ready for stardom. They're ready for fame. They're ready for their close-up.
Come on, girls. Let's go shopping.
This is the story of three hard-working guys.
What kind of cabaret do you do?
We dress up in women's clothes and parade around mouthing the words to other people's songs.
Who are about to discover...
Ta-da!
Been asked to do a show out of town?
How long is the run?
4 weeks.
That hitting the road is hard.
I hereby christen this budget Barbie camper Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Especially in heels.
Sorry.
Along the way, they'll discover surprises.
It's Gabardine! I haven't seen Gabardine for years!
Uncovers secrets.
Is it true that her real name's Ralph? I'm gonna smack his face so hard.
And learn that with friends like these...
How long have we been on the road?
4.5 hours.
Life's never a drag.
What's happening?
I don't know.
Oh, my God. Where are we?
You got us into this, and I suggest you start thinking about how to get us back.
I mean, who runs this bloody hotel in the middle of nowhere anyway?
My wife. I'm married.
This is getting too weird.
Come on, girls.
Rehearsal time.
Haven't got any kids stashed away out there as well, have you?
Mr. Belrose?
Yes?
It's a boy.
You actually make money by dressing up like a woman?
Oh, sure. I can make a fine living in a pair of heels.
Prepare for a comedy that just may change the way you think.
Tony Haddam, this is Mr. and Mrs. Spencer.
Hello.
No, wait!
The way you feel.
Who taught you to waltz?
My wife.
And most of all...
Aren't we fabulous?
The way you dress.
How many times do I have to tell you green is not your color?
The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Do you have the Texas Chainsaw Mascara?
Now there's a gentleman.
Oh, this wonderful little movie.
What a film. What an absolute goldmine. For those who have never come across it before, my God, I feel so sorry for you. It's written and directed by Stephen Elliott, but more importantly, well, not importantly, but more overtly, starring Hugo Weaving, Guy Pearce, a very young Guy Pearce, Terrence Stamp. Yeah, and Terrence Stamp as three drag queens traveling from one end of Australia to like halfway through, but like essentially the other. If you're going all the way to Alice Springs, you've gone far enough. No one in Australia will ask any more of you. You probably shouldn't have gone that far.
Just one thing that I think should be noted, as it does say on IMDb, you said three drag queens.
No, I'll get into that because
it is
accurate to say drag queens when referring to them as a performing troupe, because that is what they are doing. However, these are all three of them are at different stages of their life and experiences. So Guy Pearce is playing this very young, very bubbly party idiot. Like you're just a dumb little gay party idiot.
Yeah.
And you love fun and drugs and fun. And you know what? Sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah, no, emphasis on idiot, because his character is the one where I have the most questions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he's a special little trooper. In the middle is Hugo Weaving, our protagonist, who has lived kind of a life somewhat already before becoming an out drag queen, involving a previous wife and a child. And this is really a film about his semi-midlife crisis, coming to terms with, like, being a father, what that means, especially as a traveling drag queen.
Yeah.
What on earth could that have meant, especially in 1994? And it's about him having to travel to Alice Springs to go and meet his ex-wife and his child for some legal custody issues, essentially. And it's his mentality and progress kind of going through the motions of accepting this concept and even, you know, like, accepting the idea of, like, fatherhood, of, like, how is a drag queen, you know, and these are questions that he's bringing up. How's a drag queen supposed to be a role model as a father? Like, and what does that mean? And where, you know, the roles of fatherhood and masculinity and performative masculinity. And then we get to Terrence Stamp, who plays I don't want to say senior or elder, but an aged transgender woman who at the very beginning of the film is at a funeral for her husband, who yeah. has passed. So she has lived an entire life. So, you know, she is an old drag queen. She's done drag performances her entire life. That, you know, she did drag, and that led into her transgender identity and the surgery and such. And she kept performing a little bit after, like, she obviously kept it up, but for the most part, she was kind of retired. But now that her stable life that she had like this dream of what she wanted. She had a husband. She was living the life of a wife, and now she is a widow. And what does that mean for any queer person, let alone, you know, a transgender woman in 1994, where the moment anyone figures out who you used to be, all kinds of problems arise and issues. And so she is essentially coming along on this quest with some strange fatalism in which she's not too sure where she's going in her life, in a life that was supposed to already be settled and kind of like coming towards its at least golden years. You know, nothing new is supposed to happen. And it's these three queer journeys towards various levels of maturity as they travel across the vast outback in a pink bus named Priscilla. And that's the film. There are subplots, and it's a film of, like, subplots and subchapters, and it's very much a Canterbury Tale approach to storytelling. We move along a little bit towards our goal, and some tales occur. We move a little bit further along, some tales occur. You go to a village, you meet the locals, you have an adventure, you get the fuck out.
Yeah, and if they run out of tails, the camera just starts making love to the Australian outback.
Yeah, and if it's not making love to the Australian outback, then they just have them dance drag in front of the yeah. Australian outback. I mean, there's so many options in this. I mean, first of all, this film has a fantastic soundtrack. It is very cliche. It is essentially the it's like playing Creedence Clearwater Revival over a Vietnam war scene. That's yeah. how cliche this soundtrack is. But, you know, it probably did a lot of work towards making it that cliche. Like, this is the one that built that cliche. Marvel in its original uses of the stereotypical songs, disco songs.
Oh, yeah. Like, to give you an idea of how cliche this soundtrack is, when you hear it, you will only have one question. Where's Cher?
Yeah, there is a disturbing lack. This soundtrack is so cliche, it became a jukebox musical in 2006 based on the success of this film. It began in Sydney, Australia, of course, because the Aussies love it. We'll get into that. And that's a really good sign. That's a really good sign. But this became a successful and popular jukebox musical. And in that musical, because of the obvious lack, they have inserted Cher. I believe it's "Can You Believe in Life After Love?"
I believe, don't quote me. I would assume.
It's ever so good. I mean, not to say that Cher doesn't have other things that drag queens have been known to drag out. Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, no, I mean, like, I used to go to cosplay dance nights at our Men's and Molly's, our local gay bar, when we had the local gay bar.
Had one. We used to have a whole street. Now it's nothing.
And it was pretty much every time Do You Believe in Life After Love came on, I'm just there like, yep, okay, the experience is now complete.
Once you are the owner, now you have become the master. But yeah, back to this delightful film. It was shot on the cheap. Cost about $2 million US. Like, this really is just three actors for the most part. That's your main cast. Various extras, a couple of like B cast characters, who are all mostly made up of like local players. This film is like, you know, every time I watch it, I can't help but think of this. I might as well get out of the way right now. And I can't even say it's the gay Mad Max, because Mad Max is pretty fucking gay.
Oh, no. You know what? What I would say?
But it's definitely a Mad Max film.
It is. I mean, if you're going to do a film in Australia, the Mad Max comparisons are just inevitable. But what I kept going to was, this is Blues Brothers with drag queens.
It's also Blues Brothers with drag queens.
It is absolutely that.
Less on the religious overtones. I actually thought of a wonderful, stupid essay the other day where I would argue that Blues Brothers, the original Blues Brothers film, is an apocryphal text. Like, in terms of the biblical canon. Because, no, God is very much an acting character in that, and multiple what would be deemed miracles occur in front of witnesses to further the end of saving the orphanage. Like, that fucking film is apocrypha. Anyway, we'll get into that.
But I mean, like, in all seriousness, at the end of the day, basically, they're on a quest to go to North Australia to perform at Tick's like wife's hotel. So they're on a quest, just like the Blues Brothers. They keep ending up in these small towns where they do not fit in until they
not
perform,
at all,
just like the Blues Brothers.
And to various extents of success and not, just like the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, yeah, like, both find a lot of anger, aggression, and violence around the country bar. Oh, my. Needs more chicken wire so you can throw bottles at John Belushi.
And they also seem to have a talent for discovering other potential drag queens along the way.
I mean, that's just what happens when you're overtly queer. You attract other people who just haven't quite come out. And so, yeah, there is an older fella. He's kind of like a traveling random Ozzy Bushman dude. Like he's an older white guy who has a wife who he bought from the Philippines. She is a very problematic character because she's a overt racist stereotype, and it's like, where the fuck did this one major problem come from in this film? What the hell? Yeah, anyway, she does a ping pong trick. She's a thing. Like, the performer is fantastic, and she has gone on the record saying, like, no, like, it's supposed to be over the top and horrible, but it's like, that doesn't translate well.
Yeah.
At all. Even at the time, critics were like, this is really bad. This one thing in an otherwise incredible film. And I'm pretty sure that once again, by the time they got to the musical, they changed that shit. Not going to have it.
Oh,
investors
no,
do not want that.
If nothing else, even ignoring the offensive elements of the character, and she's such a stereotypical savage that her picture has to be in the dictionary beside that stereotype.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, like, but when I picture especially the outfits she wears, it's like, no, this was made with every single terrible stereotype about Asian women, Filipino women. And it's like, no, this is so bad.
This is so bad.
And it is a reference to a habit that, like, Australian men in the 50s, 60s, and 70s kind of, like, demographically got into, of if they couldn't find someone in Australia, they would just essentially go and hire a wife and bring her back. And it's like, this was, you know, this was a thing that was done. And, like, the old Bushman dude is kind of just, he's just that gross. We later find out he's actually, you know, like, he's bisexual or pansexual, and has been in the closet since he watched, since the day of the Lay Girls in the, I believe that would be the 40s and 50s in Australia, an actual drag troupe that was headline news and very popular in Australia during the 50s, definitely during the 50s, possibly the late 40s, possibly the late 60s. And it's one of those weird things where, like, same with Christine Jorgensen. Initially, when it was reported, oh my God, this man became a woman, it was all like fawning praise for medical science and shit. And then only later did it become, hey, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. It's like, you dumb fucks. You can get razzle-dazzled, and then your brain comes on. Ugh.
Yeah, well, I mean, also, with the Filipino wife character, there is the simple fact that I don't know how she would work in a musical.
Yeah, no, she would grind it to a halt as is. Like, she would have a number, and I believe that the way that they replaced her in a less offensive way, she has her performance number involving ping pongs, though not in the same way, obviously, because this is a family musical. But if you know, then you get the joke in it and all that, and you turn it into a song, that's fine. But she is otherwise so completely disruptive to everything. Like, she is the anti yes and. No. No and. There is no and. No but. Why not? Fuck it.
The simple fact is here, that wife, she's not even really a character. Like, I get wanting to go super over the top and all that, but even then,
it's kind of super. It's not even two dimensional. It's one dimensional. She is screeching wife. Then add racial stereotype on top of screeching wife. And she is, there's only two representations of cis women in this film that I can think of, aside from like random like extras. A couple of random extras exist, but for the most part, like in terms of people who get lines and extended characterization, yeah, unfortunately, that counts as an extended characterization. There's her, and then there's Tick's wife, who is more not Deus Ex Machina, but like a
really enthusiastic ally.
Yeah, really enthusiastic ally. I was going to say she's the Buddha at the end of the tale, the Journey to the West. She's that ultimate thing that, like, she's not a character. She is a goal, but not in like a way of you have to win her. Once you reach her, she will have the answers. She will decide. Oz will know all. Oz sees and tells all. And of course, holy shit. Maybe this is a Wizard of Oz reference in gay media. Wait, has that ever been done before? Wizard of Oz? Anyway, you get to the Emerald City and you're rewarded with a kid. Just handing out kids.
I think in a lot of respects, the only way that could be more on the nose would be if her name actually was Dorothy.
Yeah. Oh, God. That's at the end of it. However, along the way, we also meet a couple of Aborigines, one of who has a penchant for drag once they get a chance to try it out. I wish, and I hope that, again, I have not actually seen the musical. I'm just basing it on what I have read and heard of it and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they turn them more into like a larger traveling group. And so
I could see
those
that.
Characters stick around, and that was needed. Like, have these side characters stick around more.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, because I was kind of surprised that didn't happen in the movie.
Yeah, and it's one of those things of like, you know, it's what you would presume to happen. Who the hell knows? Like maybe it was just about keeping the script tight, and it's like, no, these are the three. They go on their journey, they visit people, they move on. They visit people, they move on. With the exception of the old bushman with the wife, who, when she abandons him, good for her, by the way, for just being like, no, fuck this shit. I didn't ask to be dragged into the middle of the outback. Fuck this. And she leaves him in a white Volkswagen Beetle that, like, and just drives off into the distance. And it's like, I hope she's okay. but he comes back, and because he has fallen in love with, I'm trying to remember Terrence Stamp's character's name.
Bernadette.
That's why it's such a... Because he has fallen, and he comes back because he has fallen in love with Bernadette.
Don't call her Bernie. Don't call her Bernice. She will beat the shit out of you.
She will beat the fucking shit out of you. And like, you think, okay, Terrence Stamp, great actor, obviously, most well known for Zod. Obviously, Zod.
Yeah,
Zod.
And it's like, say, you know, we've all seen Terrence Stamp's Zod, so we know he can do camp.
Yeah, we know he can do camp, but it's often considered like his greatest role. It's pantomime camp nonsense. He's a fantastic actor who is capable of doing like really hardcore, incredible acting. But Zod is considered his greatest role. And that is only said by people, I swear, who have not seen Priscilla. Because,
it's right here.
Bernadette
right
is
here.
More terrifying than Zod. I would rather piss off Zod than Bernadette.
Yeah, yeah. No, he had as his Bernadette, like, she has such a B. Arthur / kind of Helen Mirren thing going that you could tell me that they were doing a Helen Mirren biopic and they had cast Terrence Stamp as Helen Mirren, and it would—I'm sorry—that would work.
It could work. There's a way of making it work. And it's such a brilliant way of playing a character that alludes to so much past without actually saying anything. Like,
yeah,
it's a brilliant stoic performance of like reserved, controlled femininity. So brilliantly well done. And it just, you can feel the years that she has survived. Like, this is someone who has done this through some really scary times in some really inhospitable places. And she just, it's made her into like fucking iron. You know, she's rock hard, and you're not going to fucking do anything to her that she doesn't want you to. You're not going to, if she doesn't want you right, fuck off. If she, you know, like, there is no restraint. There is no control that she, like, there's nothing society has on her anymore. And she's not afraid of any of you fucks. Yeah.
Oh, it's not even just that she's not afraid. There's almost an air of she's above you in some ways. But yeah. it's not elitist. It's more
no.
You can clearly tell she has just gained all of this experience that she has almost earned the right to look down on you.
Yeah, she knows far. She's had these experiences. She has far more, you know, like in her pinky finger than you have in your entire life. And like her reserved control, like elite grace, is beautifully contrasted with our young idiot of the group, who is none of it. He is tasteless. He is crass. He is careless in so many ways, of other people's feelings, of his surroundings, of how he comes off or what he's even saying. He is the epitome of misspent youth.
Oh, no, there are literally large sections of the movie where I honestly thought Adam was suicidal.
You could see it coming. Like, if they had taken that path, absolutely. And Guy Pearce plays this character who Lesser would turn him into a joke caricature. And
he
definitely gets some of the best lines. He does. But when shit goes to fuck, Guy Pearce has a very real fear and naivety that he can play on. That comes through so beautifully well. And your overwhelming annoyance at this character, not at the character itself, but like at their behavior to the other characters, the same behavior that is annoying those characters, all of that vanishes in a moment in just like sympathetic concern for this, you know, God's own idiot. Truly, someone who is used to never having to deal with more problems than simply pissing someone off and them being angry at him. Like, the worst thing that has ever happened before to this moron has definitely been feuding with someone in a club. You know?
Yeah, and then eventually, he gets one hell of a reality check.
Yeah, he almost gets dragged. And it's a very terrifying and sudden scene in the deep Australian outback in a work camp for an opal mine, which are, well, at least used to be quite frequent and were like the roughest of the rough spots in Australia. Because it's Australians in the outback and they're all mining people. You know, all they do is dig all day in the heat. And then they go and fucking drink until they have to dig in the heat all over again. You know, these are gruff people. And their show doesn't go down as well as it goes in some other places.
No, it wasn't even just that. If I remember, I think there's a certain degree of Adams starts screwing with one of the miners and kind of leading them on, and
oh yeah, no, like there's a lot of idiotic playing into, and it's just like I've talked to people, I've interviewed like people who have known others who did this way back in like the 50s and 60s, and like apparently there was one incredible drag queen in Halifax in the 60s who was so good, and like, you know, she only performed like in front of queer audiences, so very very secret, hush. So the public didn't know about it. It's not like our current drag queens where I'm trying to remember, like there one of them was an official city mascot at one point, if I recall. Like Rouge Fatale had
I was just gonna ask if that was Rouge.
Yeah, yeah. Rouge Fatale is some sort of like official ambassador for the city. And it's like,
basically,
anyway. This drag queen would get done up and go to a really fucking dangerous bar and get free drinks all night from all the boys. And it's just like, it never backfired, but like, holy fucking shit, that is terrifying as all get out. And
you can't help but think what could have happened.
Yeah, and our beautiful idiot in this case is not really passing. He's in a drag outfit. It very over, and it's like, you are just, as you say, it would have been fitting, it would have made sense from a narrative point of view if immediately after that, when they're like, why did you do that? He confessed that he has a little bit of a fatalist streak.
Yeah.
It would have made sense. Instead, we don't get that. There's just like, he has to deal with it. Like they show that they do actually have concern and love for this moron. And he has to kind of come to terms with like, oh, so this was a wake up for me. And after that, he's less of a little shithead for the most part.
Yeah, a little bit less.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't say that that's a good response, though. I definitely wouldn't say that's a good reason to have a drag, though, you know, or to assault a queer person, but. Yeah, narratively it worked out. That's a bad lesson.
Yeah, oh yeah, it works. However,
yeah. Now, on the upside, when this movie came out, Australians' like attitude towards queer people was very much as it is portrayed at, you know, throughout this film. Most people don't really give a shit, but a lot of people were really kind of aggressive. But overt pro-queerness was, like, very rare. You know, rare. And this was so damn popular almost immediately that it actually helped the entire Australian queer community get that wedge in and start normalizing with people. And it is to the point now that the town in the film that they visit and they get run out of, and was very much that rough, like it was a nasty fucking scary place, a lot of those extras were quite violent and dangerous apparently, it has a annual gay pride parade that is always Priscilla themed, and the entire town comes out for it. And it's actually at this point a tourist draw. People go to that little shithole town specifically for drag.
Nice. Oh, like that is, I'm literally getting goosebumps as you're saying that. That is so wonderful.
Yeah. This film has become so accepted and really quickly became very accepted by Australians, and thus helped forward queerness as part of the Australian identity, and the 2000 Summer Olympics closing ceremonies. 2000, this is 22 years ago. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, was included in their cultural, like, everything Australian cultural performance. There was drag at the Olympics.
Nice.
Because of this film.
Yeah.
Yeah. This film has done so much for acceptance and the gay community. It's fantastic. And not every gay film will do that. First of all, especially at this time, a lot of them were really depressing. If they weren't really depressing, they were essentially saying, like, being gay will turn you evil. Then you'll kill someone, do some of the marijuanas, and die. And it's like, oh, that's okay, cool, great, thank you. But a lot of gay comedies were more just bitchy affairs, like The Birdcage. The Birdcage is fantastic. It's heartfelt. Yeah. But it's very much like it's not trying to take you along on a journey to understand necessarily people in the same way. It's a quirky misunderstanding comedy that is trying to intentionally paper over aspects that people would judge. This is overt. Here are our foibles. Here are our problems. Here are the things that we do for joy. Here is every aspect that you know, stereotyped, shortened, all of that, cliched. But and now we take that. We take all of that. We introduce to you whole characters, and we take them on a journey of self-discovery that, like, I feel lies at the Australian heart. Going on a walkabout in the outback.
Yeah.
Come the fuck on. That's the most Australian thing ever. And so it just like latched on to their cultural identity as a nation. And now Australia is, I think, considered one of, like, the second or third safest people for, like, even overt trans people in the world. Thanks to Bernadette. Thanks to Terrence Stamp, I am safer.
Oh, you know, like,
That's what you get when you let Zod rule!
But between Zod and Bernadette, if I ever actually met Terrence Stamp, I'd make no mistake, I would kneel before that man.
Oh God, how many people do that constantly? Just like, he probably just like now has this reaction. He doesn't even look down. He just notices it subconsciously in his periphery, and he walks around them. Nope. People just throwing themselves in front of Terrence Stamp, and he's like, yes, yes.
Or he's so just so deadpan. He's just looking at you like,
you just shifts into the glare, the Bernadette glare, and you're like, yeah. I gotta get out of here before I burst into flames. I don't know what's worse, Zod's heat vision or that.
I mean, Terrence Stamp's work here is just perfection to the point that Bernadette and Bob is just this so charming, kind of slow burn love story.
Like, that's the thing. He's a pig. He's a pig. It's literally shown by the way he treats his wife. But together they work. It's like,
yeah.
What the shit? The obvious assertion is if he had just manned up and asked a lay girl way back in the old days to marry him, he would have been happy.
Pretty much, yeah. He's a dick to everyone else to the point that those minors like know him and he fits in with them.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like, then with the drag queens.
He's quite large compared to the rest of them. Like, you get a feeling that no one's gonna give him shit for any of this.
No. Well, I mean, until Adam showed up, because he did try to save Adam first, and it didn't, it wasn't quite enough.
By then it was definitely, yeah, it was too little too late of like, no, they were about to kill him. That's different. Yeah. And of course it's all a message of like, you know, you need more allies. Otherwise, you know, you never know when society will simply decide to turn on you. Hey, Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. Texas, Arkansas, Alabama, any southern state, really.
Did you know Houston used to have the highest per capita population of gay people in America?
I didn't know that, but I can kind of see it. And I could see how that would, I could see how that would freak out a lot of Republicans.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Americans love this film, to be clear. Obviously not like right-wing assholes, but Americans immediately reacted to this film really well. You know, it didn't do gangbusters in the theaters. It was still like a foreign film randomly out of nowhere, and a foreign film about queermos. Ew. But once they actually got in and saw it, they were laughing their asses off. Apparently at the test screening, the American audience laughed at Terrence Stamp's line, Felicia has left her cake out. For 10 solid minutes, you know, because they actually got like, they got the MacArthur Park joke, but way harder for some reason. And like, it's a great line, but what in the shit? 10 minutes? What? Wow. You had to stop the film at that point because you've missed entire sections. Yeah. I think it made over 30 million, which is at least over 28 million more than its operating budget. So like wildly successful.
Million budget. That's huge.
Yeah, that's enormous. And like not just domestically, that's doing some American numbers, and those American numbers being positive. And of course, then DVD and VHS went fucking nuts. But I just realized, you know who we haven't talked about its performance in this entire thing? The fucking main character, Hugo Weaving, looking emaciated.
He's stick thin, but for a drag queen, he's kind of perfect, because you look at that like body, you couldn't do anything, any gender, anything.
Yeah, it's like, damn, Hugo Weaving. I say had because I haven't seen Hugo Weaving in something tight in a very long time. Like Elrond's robes are very flowy. Like, very comfortable, I'm sure. But damn, he had like a swimmer's body. That was like, you're a stick. That's ridiculous. It was fascinating to see, and you've never seen like tiny Hugo Weaving. I saw Hugo Weaving first in The Matrix, so like going from such a constant threat to such a sympathetic and albeit neurotic character who you just want to follow along on this journey. Fantastic work having someone that seemed to be like constantly distracted by the obvious thing at the end of this journey.
He is clearly hiding so much, and then by the time you get to the final act and more is revealed, is just, you just feel for him so much.
Yeah. And when the film takes the super happy ending choice of the child enjoying the drag performance that they give at Alice Springs, and him getting a chance to have a relationship as a father with his son, you know, it it's all happy and nice, and it's like, oh, there's so many options where this film could have just like swerved right into like drama tragedy, like taking a hard Rent-esque swerve into killing off the most queer person in a moment. It manages not to.
Yeah, but also one thing that, if I just may, as an early childhood educator and also kind of addressing some of the things that have come up with drag queens in the news today, that ending, the relationship with his kid, like happy, nice, as you said, but also accurate because kids don't fucking care.
Yeah, the kids really don't fucking care. Like, kids really don't fucking care. Kids play dress up. They fucking concept.
I have over the years have had little boys that would come into work wearing a Disney princess dress because that was just what they wanted to wear that day.
Yeah, and it's like, yep, all right. It's like, hey, we gotta get him out the door. I don't care.
no, the parents don't fucking care. And to me, the kids.
Yeah, I have to get to nice fucking dress. Work. Yeah, it's just, what's up? Nice. Looking good. Whoop. And no one else really gives them shit because no one actually cares except for dickheads anymore. Thank God. It's just this is a film that is almost 30 years old. It's 28 years old currently. And it's still having to reaffirm that very basic concept that, like, a drag queen can be around a child and it's not a bad thing.
No, I'm saying kids just want to be read an enjoyable story. They don't give a fuck what the reader is wearing.
Yeah, plus, I mean, come on, show me the difference between a typical Disney musical segment and a drag show. It's colorful, it's pageant, they're often campy. Almost every single Disney villain in the 90s was a drag queen to some extent, whether in face or not. Come on. Just all of this is so wonderfully, it's decadent but also wholesome decadence.
The biggest thing for me was I had heard of the movie. I thought I was familiar with it, but turns out I knew absolutely nothing about the movie. And when I say that I knew nothing about the movie, I thought Priscilla was a character. I had no idea. I had no idea Priscilla was the name of the bus.
I mean, yeah, like they're going to meet Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and she will give them three wishes.
or like one of them was just a drag queen named Priscilla.
Yeah. And the bus is a character in this. It's lavish on the inside. It starts out as a normal bus. It then gets, unfortunately, slurs painted on it, which stay for a bit of time. And then it becomes a hot pink monstrosity due to a musical montage segment in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, and you're also, there is a split second where you're going, why does Adam have cans of pink paint on this bus?
But it's very convenient, who the hell cares? And the truth is, the answer is because it's Adam. Adam intended on throwing them at Bernadette. Like, this is a constructive outcome of his chaos. Otherwise, it was just going to be that stupid can on top of a door joke constantly until he has properly ruined every outfit she owns. And it would be hilarious every time.
the tragic thing is that somehow, some way, yeah, probably would.
Yeah. No, this film's wonderful. It sticks with you in weird ways. Every now and then I'll find myself humming three fat trannies, and it's like, oh shit. So anyway, if you love fun, if you love happiness, if you love a good disco soundtrack, and if you love just like that early 90s period where America went stupid for Australia, thank God this landed at that time. I definitely suggest you check this film out. Check out Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, or fuck it, go see the musical.
Yeah.
Have one up on me, you bastards.
Oh, no, if I had the money, I would happily go see the musical. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Yeah, I very much... Inevitably, it will come here to Halifax in a decade or two. Someday
soon, someday not soon at all.
But I'm gonna go see that. That's gonna be some good shit.
No doubt, yeah. No, and until then, like I was telling you on chat, let's remake. We need a remake.
We need a remake, but also not a remake because it's so good. Oh God,
yeah.
Don't remake it. We'll get it. It'll get all wrong. It'll get all fuckered up.
Or like even if it's not a remake, like the proverbial, I would say not a sequel, but the good old spiritual successor. But like I said, like we take out ABBA, we put in Lady Gaga, and now that I'm thinking about it, we'll throw some Kesha in there for good measure.
Oh yes, you're telling me that it's a great idea. It's a good approach to it. Yeah,
and we're casting Jordan Gavaris as Adam, like.
Mm-hmm.
I want Jordan Gavaris in this hypothetical movie.
You know, I'm very surprised that this was never Americanized because it would be so very easy to have them start out as like East Coast performers or West Coast performers. It doesn't fucking matter. And they have to go through Middle America. Like, I'm very surprised there has not been an American version of this. And I think it's just because the original popped off so well.
I mean, no, there's that, but I'm also kind of thinking, do you know what came first between this and Tu Wong Fu?
Tu Wong Fu came second because Tu Wong Fu references this. And okay. Yes, I would definitely say that is kind of the same thing, but I believe it was already in production when they... like saw the obvious greatness that was being done with it and was like, okay, we got to reference this shit somehow. By the way, yeah, we're not doing So Long to Wong Fu next week. It would be lovely to sooner than later, because that's a fantastic film. A terrific Swayze.
Yeah.
Unquestionably some of Swayze's best work.
And that's also another one that I've never seen, so.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, like, there could absolutely be fun to be had there.
Yeah, Wesley Snipes is amazing. We will at some point get into that, but, it's time to finally reveal the fourth part of Pride Week. Yes, I've kept it very secret from you, the listener, this entire time, but not from Mike because he had to prepare.
now, I got my baby in this with the Carmilla movie. Now it's Crash's turn.
Yeah, and web series adaptation, eh? Yeah, that's cute. How about 20-year-old indie film from Ottawa, shot in the streets and the back of gay and punk clubs? Oh yeah, and if you have any hint, listener, I hope you're screaming right now with joy. It's got luchadors, baby. It's got demons. It's got musicals. It's got a trans love affair between the holiest of holies and a beautiful homeless woman. It has fighting and attempts to recreate the Matrix on a budget of $0. It has the best spots in Ottawa when I was back in high school. Yeah, all right. It's fucking Rowan. We're doing it. It's Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter.
Oh, God. No, I can't wait for this because everything that you have said from the moment you brought this movie up just screams perfect movie for me.
Imagine if Hobo with a Shotgun was actually a valid Grindhouse film and not just referencing them. That's this.
But
tons of sacrilege and God appearing in the form of a talking pie.
So, this is the perfect movie for me to check out. But also, I've always said that I love the idea of bringing movies that people have basically never heard of to this show. Mm. So this movie is perfect for me. This movie is perfect for this show. I haven't even seen the movie yet, and I already know that this thing is perfect on goddamn levels.
Yes, and it's available for free on YouTube. You don't even have to scrounge through one of three record stores in Ottawa that used to sell a VHS tape copy of it for $40. Fuck me, did I want that? No, did I never buy it. I pirated this shit as every proper punk would do, and then gave copious amounts of money to the production staff who worked at my favorite bar. Anyway, there are stories. I will get into it. It's going to be a fun one to record. Oh, my God.
This is going to be amazing.
Yeah, and speaking of films that are right up that alley, I would also like to assert that next month I want to bring to the show Man with a Screaming Brain, starring Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, that might be doable. I mean, I had wanted to do a Canucksploitation.
Then we can do it after.
Well, yeah, no, we can do that, but also there's a simple fact that I think Thor Love and Thunder is also early next month.
Yay.
So yay. We can't do the full month of Canucksploitation anyway.
Oh, well, no, wait. Thor Love and Thunder counts because they get a tax credit in Quebec. It's CanCon. I think it literally does count as CanCon because they can point to the tax credits and be like, no, see? Right there. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, saga is CanCon. I can't wait for that Heritage Minute where it's just someone in Montreal signing a funding release, and it goes off, and it's like, what was that for? I don't know, something called Iron Man, and then it's just, and the rest is Canadian history. We're totally responsible for the Infinity Saga and Superman. You're welcome. Also, yeah, basketball. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please like, share, subscribe, leave a comment, and let us know what you think about it. And if you want to get a little more personal, a little more intimate, a little more up close, give us a call. No, fuck that. Send us an email.
No. Hey, damn sure not getting my phone number.
Where can they email us again?
You can reach us at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at realgeekshfx.
Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week with more B-roll, which just came out today. oops. And, of course, Jesus Christ, Vampire Hunter!
Oh, and don't worry, I swear the B-roll won't be as dark this time.
Not as dark. B-roll content!